This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Saturday, August 7th, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. When President Biden moved forward with another moratorium on evictions spurred by the pandemic and pressure from his fellow Democrats, he did so against the advice of his own lawyers, previous rulings from the courts, including the Supreme Court, and a radically less serious set of circumstances than a year ago. Cato's Walter Olson takes us through the relevant facts.
Let's do a little background here first. What did the CDC say last year when you and I spoke, and you said that the CDC's eviction moratorium has some weak grounding in law, but probably is that wouldn't stand up to scrutiny?
Yeah, I said at the time that when the CDC, under the direction of then President Trump, declared a nationwide moratorium on evictions, I said its legal basis for doing so was very flimsy. It cited a statutory provision giving it something of a blank ticket authority to combat communicable disease epidemics as part of a list of things like fumigating arriving shipments for pests and quarantining travelers who go across state lines, a list of traditional public health powers closely linked to preventing traditional public health dangers. And then it said, and whatever other, I mean, I don't remember the exact phrase, but there was an et cetera kind of clause. Now, et cetera clauses are always dangerous. And the reading that the CDC had to apply back then in order to pretend to authority was that this et cetera clause envisioned giving the CDC a power over the entire national economy, over contracts between landlord and tenant in all 50 states, over a power to rewrite contracts, a power to prevent the operations of state and municipal courts to handle certain businesses. In short, something of an absolute power over a very far-flung section of the economy. And if they did have that power, then you may well ask, and federal judges did ask in the course of the litigation, wouldn't that amount to giving them complete power over everything? And so I cited a famous line from Justice Antonin Scalia about statutory interpretation, which is that Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes. And by referring to hiding elephants in mouse holes, he meant that a seemingly normal, boring, ordinary statute does not usually use miscellaneous language somewhere along the line to do something drastically out of scale, as well as out of general harmony with the purpose on paper of what the statute is about. I think it fits the situation perfectly. Congress, in enacting this statute about traditional public health functions that the federal government might have, was not trying to smuggle in, nor should we interpret it as having smuggled in, dictatorial power over all aspects of society.
So, in response, what did courts tell the CDC and the Biden administration about this eviction moratorium?
It was, of course, sued in multiple courts, multiple federal courts, and took quite a while to percolate through the system. The CDC did not lose all the cases, but it certainly, from what I can tell, lost most of the cases. And in particular, it lost cases at the appeals court level. And then when the Supreme Court was presented with a stay question, and lawyers can go on about how the issues are framed in a slightly different way when it's a stay, and this was not a fully argued case, nor did it result in full majority and minority opinions, but the Supreme Court came out with an unusual but not unprecedented 5-4 decision, or really 4-4 with one in the middle decision, in which the only justice who wrote giving his reasons was Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the one in the middle. And the four liberal justices had taken the view, at this level of considering a stay, we are not going to declare the thing to be unlawful. That doesn't mean that they might not look seriously at the issues of illegality once it was briefed. You shouldn't assume that the four Liberals would vote to uphold what the CDC did. On the other hand, you probably can assume that the four Conservatives, when I say four Liberals, by the way, that's the way that Chief Justice John Roberts and the three Liberals voted. However, four Conservatives would have given the Alabama Association of Realtors relief and did clearly signal, even though they didn't write an opinion, that they considered the CDC's action to be unlawful, to be ungrounded in statute. And then in the middle, there was Brett Kavanaugh, who joined Roberts and the Liberals on the stay issue, again, on this procedural thing, but wrote a little explanation saying, in my view, you know, they can't possibly justify having this authority, but it's going to expire in a matter of weeks anyway. And rather than upset the apple cart, I'm going to withhold this relief for the Alabama realtors on the understanding that Congress would have to go back and enact something that was much more clearly designed to give them this power, or else Alabama realtors would just win outright. So you had Kavanaugh taking a position and the four Conservatives clearly taking at least as strong and probably a stronger position that the authority just wasn't there. And as a matter of convenience and prudence, Kavanaugh was going to give them a few weeks, not an unusual judicial resolution. When the government is found to be doing something illegal, you don't necessarily pull down the columns of the building that has been constructed. You may give them time to, with all deliberate speed, you know, move over to a legal setup. And that's what Kavanaugh was doing. But so the court had spoken, and it had spoken, in my view, clearly and intelligibly. I stress that we don't know whether Roberts or the three Liberals might also have come along with some of this because their view was purely procedural. But I think we can know to a good degree of certainty that for five justices and majority, the CDC just doesn't have this power.
This new moratorium issued by the CDC with apparently the full support of the President of the United States was after courts rendered these their various opinions. So is there any doubt that the Biden administration is aware that what they are doing is illegal?
I would put it that way. They could raise objections or quibbles, call them what you will, but you know, their lawyers, well, let's talk about what their lawyers have said, because it's a way of understanding President Biden's own best judgment of what was going on, because he explained in quite recent days that he had quizzed his lawyers. He had asked whether there was any way of interpreting the legal situation so as to preserve the authority. And he had been told, no, the weight of opinion is that you don't have the authority and we don't see any way out. So he said that, his spokespeople said that. And then after political pressure, he did the old switcheroo. Now, the argument that they are now offering is, well, it's not the same moratorium. We changed around a little bit. We've exempted it's something like 10% of the country that has the lowest virus incidence, and we're not going to presume to cover them. So it's only a 90% rather than 100% version of what happened before. A couple of problems. First, that very issue came up a few days earlier, and the president said that the lawyers had advised that that also would not fly legally. And of course, the lawyers were right. It's not a different in concept thing where suddenly statutory authority appears miraculously when you didn't have it before. It is instead a not very different, not really more rational or less arbitrary attempt to create a different case so as to prevent the audience from noticing that there is on point precedent that they are defying. And so, you know, it just wouldn't fly in most courtrooms. If, you know, if a court had dealt you a loss on a certain basis, and you would come back saying, oh, look, I've reshuffled the old hands, and now I've got a three of diamonds instead of a three of hearts, and otherwise holding the same hand, the court would say, get out here. You know, you are trying to evade the precedent that you had earlier sought and gotten.
So if I'm a landlord, and it's notable here that this moratorium extends to couples making up to $198,000 a year who believe that they would be rendered homeless if the moratorium did not continue, that they've had trouble paying rent, et cetera. That's a whole other issue.
Yeah, it is remarkable that the twin rationale of the original moratorium, namely that there might be contagion from making people move from a two-bedroom to a one-bedroom apartment, or there might be contagion from having the sheriff and the movers, you know, crowd into the apartment while vacating it or ordering it vacated. To the extent that there was ever, and the second rationale, by the way, was that we're in an economic emergency. You know, the economy is in free fall. It was certainly widely believed some of these things in the early weeks and first few months, but neither the contagion rationale nor the economic rationale looks anything like the way it did more than a year later. You have the vaccine. So the sheriff and the moving van employees and pretty much everyone else who is above 16 can protect themselves from for free, because the vaccine is free, from the alleged dangers of having to get too close to each other while moving to smaller quarters. Secondly, the economic rationale, which was always wildly overbroad, not just because of that income threshold, but because the people were invited to take advantage of it based on unilateral declarations of, I'm afraid that the new lodgings I would move to would be smaller than the current ones. There is no objective attempt to bring in any hardest cases kind of thresholds. It's just kind of, bring in a note that you could have written yourself to a large extent. And so the idea was full of pretext. It was full of after-the-fact rationalization. It was a crowd-pleasing measure as far as the political reception, and yet it was an assault, as libertarians should always be on the lookout for an assault against a defined minority, namely apartment owners and those who may indeed have fewer resources and lower incomes than the tenants who are stiffing them. It did not in particular distinguish between tenants who genuinely had no other means of going on, and tenants who might have been employed. You could be well employed and stick with this. Tenants who might be leading to all sorts of good lifestyles and simply chose to inflict this damage on their landlords.
So, to the extent that landlords, who, as you know, may be making less money than the tenants that are stiffing them, this looks like a textbook regulatory taking.
It is a textbook regulatory taking. And one thing that landlords stress is that when the law has allowed arrears of months and months and months of rent to pile up, in most cases, the landlord is never going to get that back. You know, theoretically, they could try to get it back, but in most cases, the tenant can negotiate most or all of it away, or simply ignore it, and you're not going to catch up with most of the money. So that is a large lump sum that has been effectively expropriated for the benefit of a third party. And so, in fact, there have been a couple of lawsuits already saying that this is a uncompensated taken. And Cato listeners know that the courts have been very unsympathetic to property owners on regulatory takings arising from rent control or controls on eviction or compulsory renewal of leases, a whole range of things that I think logically should count as regulatory takings. The courts have refused to recognize as such and have refused to order compensation. On the other hand, the Cedar Point nursery case this year represented something of a win for property owners who got recognition of genuine property losses through occupation, in that case by union organizers. And it's caused some people to hope or fear, depending on which side they're on, that maybe the court will revisit some other regulatory takings issues too. It's an area of law that has long deserved reconsideration. Will it get it?
What's going to happen in the courts now?
There have already been a couple of actions filed, and indeed emergency actions filed by, I believe, the Alabama and Georgia Associations of Realtors. And I mentioned that the court's handling of the first round of challenges was relatively leisurely and took quite a few months. Biden himself, in really remarkably candid comments to the press, which I wonder why they didn't advise him against this, suggested that stalling for time and simply postponing the legally inevitable was an objective of what he had done. Now, it's pretty brazen to say, we know we're going to lose, but we're trying to get a few more months. If tenants said that about an occupancy situation, the landlord would rightly be angry. And I think the landlord would rightly be angry at the president saying, we know we're going to lose, but we're stalling for time. Now, someone else who gets angry sometimes at this is the courts, because the courts are more likely to fast track the hearing of challenges of this sort when they believe that the court's own authority has been the subject of nose thumbing. And I think we have just seen a gigantic and gaudy nose thumbing from the Oval Office.
So President Trump's CDC issues this moratorium. We should note this was in March of 2020 when pretty much everybody was very confused and a lot of people were scared and very concerned about the fallout and the economy and that sort of thing. This is August 2021. Courts have spoken on this issue. The Supreme Court, at the very least, said pretty clearly, come on, man. And now the Biden administration, having made clear, at least Joe Biden has been making clear, this is probably authority I don't have. We're going to do this anyway. We are largely doing this to stall for time. In a sense, he's admitting all of the things that would make him standing up on January 20th and swearing an oath to obey the Constitution. That would seem like he's just saying, yeah, what are you going to do about it?
You know, the presidential oath of office, is it like pie crust? Is it only made to be broken in the first place? I mean, that seems to be the modern view of a lot of presidents. And we could go through the list. Several of us tried to come up with parallel examples of where, and of course, it's not that hard to find instances of presidents doing things that they're pretty sure the courts will find unlawful. It is unusual in this case for them to do so soon after the Supreme Court, not just the lower court, has given a pretty clear indication of what it views the law to be. That's what's new here, and that's what could make you despair about whether presidents will ever be mindful of their oath of office if they can get away with not being.
So why not impeach a president over this?
Impeachment is up to the Houses of Congress, and they've got their own standards, which seem to depend very heavily on whether the president's party has enough votes to stave off the process. Not too much more to say about it, except that as precedent, every time one of these things is allowed to happen, every time a president gets away with one of these things, the bar falls further, and the next president is invited. It's an engraved invitation for the next president to be even more brazen. We don't know what the issue will be. We don't know whose interests are going to be ravaged next time. But it's an engraved invitation for presidents to ignore the law in the future.
Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.